Previously on the British Broadcasting Century podcast.
May 1923, and the BBC has a new London HQ, Savoy Hill, Auntie Beebe's first permanent home, launched in style with booze, bands, and blokes. Lots of blokes. In fact, the night's closing speech was listed as the first BBC men's talk, and in true men's style, it was performed by a drunken lord who had to be literally dragged up from the neighbouring Savoy Hotel bar. What a launch! So, after men's hour, a day later, time for women's hour.
This time, yes, not woman's hour on the BBC Today and ever since 1946, when it was first presented by a man, oddly, but created by Janet Quigley, who was also behind the Today programme. No, not woman's, but women's hour, the 1923 version. As we'll see on this episode, BBC Women's Hour went on quite a journey in its first year or so. Our guest, the finest expert on this, Dr. Kate Murphy, visiting fellow at Bournemouth University, former Radio 4 Women's Hour producer, author of Behind the Wireless, A History of Early Women at the BBC, and most recently, Hilda Matheson, A Life of Secrets and Broadcasts, Dr. Kate Murphy. I said her name at the start of that blurb, but it was such a long blurb, I thought I'd better say it again. Dr. Kate Murphy.
Men's hour didn't work. Women are seen as this defined audience. It's aimed at predominantly housewives. At first, it's middle class, because these are the women who are predominantly going to have wirelesses. So the tone of the programme is quite middle class. And that's the women who are coming to speak on it and who are making it. This is a really interesting programme, Women's Hour.
Oh, and I'm Paul Carenza, here with episode 84 and Women's Hour, a fascinating chapter in this 100-year-old tale, except less chapter. We're putting the chap-ess in chapter. Get on with it, Carenza. It's the British Broadcasting Century.
I don't know why I'm on.
Hello, hello, this is Paul Carenza calling.
This is London Calling.
Hello, hello. This is London Calling. And indeed, London did call on the 2nd of May, 1923, day two of London Tuolo's broadcasts from Savoy Hill. Yep, that's where we find ourselves in our moment-by-moment, slow and steady retrospective of the early days of British broadcasting. This podcast is not made by the BBC, of course, but because the BBC was, well, all the broadcasting there was in May 1923, that's the company we keep at this stage on this epic journey through the history of British broadcasting. At this point, the less than six-month-old BBC are trying this new thing of gendered programming.
Upholstering and dressmaking and cooking and beauty culture. We had lots of interesting topics, the right kind of thing for women's topics, you know.
Kathleen Garscadden. Ella Fitzgerald, not the jazz singer, has joined head office just a few weeks earlier, 7th of April 1923, to oversee Children's Hour and indeed this new Women's Hour. They'd had the occasional talk for women, by women, at this point. London's first looks like being 3rd of March 1923.
The Trend of Fashion by Florence Roberts,
who I think was an American stage and film actress, or at least shared the same name as an American stage and film actress. And that talk was followed by
The Latest Variations of the Foxtrot by Edith Baird.
The Foxtrot by Madame Edith Baird.
Who was also known as the Queen of Chess. Yes, celebrity women giving some of the first BBC women's talks. Although at that point, it was not called Women's Hour. But before long, in spring 1923, 6 days a week, they would cater to the female listenership at 5 p.m. for half an hour. Yes, Women's Hour lasts only half an hour. That's a quality for you. Then again, Children's Hour was rarely an hour either. Hour clearly just means chunk of time. A bit like when I say to my wife, I'll be about an hour editing this podcast. It's never an hour. As for the very idea of women's programming, well, it was a fairly revolutionary idea at the time, because radio at first, really, was a boy's toy. Pre-BBC, and indeed for the first BBC Christmas, radio sets were aimed at boys, young men, maybe older ones who were looking for something to tinker with in their garden sheds. But no, at this point, the domestication of broadcasting, the audience shifts. Radio is being developed as a must-have appliance for the home. It's been featured at the Daily Mail Ideal Home Exhibition by this point, and programming has broadened out that very same week as that exhibition from just evening shows to daytime as well. And who is at home during the day in the 1920s? Now, this isn't me supporting this. I'm just saying that what was happening at the time, women, married women who couldn't work because they were married, and possibly mothers as well. Either way, they might be after some programming that might appeal directly to them during the daytime at home.
They do have this almost captive audience at home of women who are housewives. By definition, they're at home.
Academic, author and expert on early women at the BBC, Dr. Kate Murphy.
This idea of when women can listen is something that, you know, way into the 30s, they have a really big conference in 1936 about when is the best time for women to listen. And there's no consensus. And interestingly, Women's Hour is at 10, you know, obviously now at 10, used to be at 2. And that kind of 10, 10.30 in the morning, sort of until 2.33 at afternoon time are the times that, if you look at women's programming, that's usually when it has been broadcast. It's interesting to have this kind of this little spot 6 days a week. Saturday is a working day for most people, but not obviously not on Sundays.
Yes, of course.
The idea for Women's Hour was apparently suggested by Cecil Lewis, the Deputy Director of Programmes, at a meeting of regional station directors of the BEEB on the 18th of April, 1923. Just a couple of weeks after that, then, Women's Hour launched on May the 2nd. So that's where we find ourselves this episode. But we'll begin just a day earlier, where we were last episode. 1st of May, 1923, the day of the opening of Savoy Hill and Lord Birkenhead's inaugural inebriated men's talk.
Men's Hour wasn't very successful. It didn't last very long. The idea was the Men's Hour, Women's Hour and Children's Hour. But then when it was broadcast, it was called Men's Talks. Children's Hour is already going, as we know. So Women's Hour. So that starts on the 2nd of May, 1923. And Men's Hour starts on the 1st of May, 1923. These are the days that the new studios are launched. And these programmes are part of that.
In fact, though, the same night as that men's talk from Lord Birkenhead, May the 1st, 1923, what else do we see elsewhere across the regional BBC network? Other women's programmes launch. A day before London launches Women's Hour officially. I just noticed this researching this episode. 1st of May 1923, 5NO Newcastle broadcast a women's transmission for the first time. Maybe to get one over on London? Those wily Geordies. It's odd, you see, how the day before that, 30th of April, the last Marconi House broadcast on London 2LO, Cecil Lewis gave essentially a trailer saying,
Women's Hour begins in London in 2 days' time.
And then the very next day, 1st of May, all these regional stations decide to start theirs before London. You see, 2ZY Manchester, they had
Women's Platform.
That was their programming on the 1st of May. Cardiff 5WA launched
Women's Hour.
So the same title as the London programme that would start a day later.
And I love the way that it's called things like, in Manchester it's called Mainly Feminine, and then it's called, or Ladies' Corner, or, you know, they've got these different titles around the country. So they're doing their own thing. They do take content from London in a way. London provides scripts, but they also do their own thing. Same with Men's Hour. They've got like Men's Corner. And
yeah, I think the Manchester station, I think, had Children's Corner rather than Children's Hour to begin with. So they probably must have then developed from there to Women's Corner and Men's Corner and all that sort of thing.
So there is this very nice sort of little local kind of autonomy, you know, in the local stations, which does, as we know, kind of gradually as a BBC grows, it becomes much more centralised, but it does start off much more local.
Like, for example, in Glasgow, 5SC is the radio station there, and Women's Hour, like Children's Hour, was hosted sometimes by children's favourite Kathleen Garscadden. Heard here with some rather amusing makeup advice for young women.
If you want to have a really good skin, a good complexion, choose a wet and windy day and go out into the garden and find a tree. Take your jar of cold cream with you, or your beauty cream. Rub it hard onto the tree trunk, as hard as you like. And after a while, come into the house and you'll find you've got a beautiful pink and white complexion.
There was a good reason why Kathleen Garscadden did women's as well as children's programmes on 5SC Glasgow. Everyone else there was a bloke.
I was the only woman on the staff of performers in those days. Nobody wanted to tackle speaking into the microphone. It was too terrifying. Couldn't get people to come and read things. So I got it all to do and all the arranging to do when it came to women's matters. And my mother was, I think, a bit horrified when she heard that I was arranging for this talk, because I was not allowed to powder my nose or put lipstick on. It was considered rather naughty.
Simultaneous broadcasting is just around the corner. That comes in the summer of 1923, and that essentially means networking. The regional stations, up until that point, fairly autonomous before London will take over and send out what they want when they want. The BBC at Savoy Hill then, on the north bank of the Thames, sort of had these two different areas. London's 2LO station, but also head office of the BBC. If you'd like to see the actual plans, link in the show notes to some plans we've just uploaded of Savoy Hill, you can see exactly who was where. And Ella Fitzgerald sharing an office there with Ralph Wade, the talks assistant. And a directive was sent out from that office then to start broadcasting these women's programmes. At 2LO London, Women's Hour was officially launched then on the 2nd of May 1923, with one or two very special dignitaries giving the first programme. Dr. Kate Murphy. I mean, it wasn't Dr. Kate Murphy as one of the dignitaries, but here she is talking about who it was on the air on the first London's Women's Hour.
It's at 5 p.m. initially, this programme. That's when they have Her Royal Highness Princess Alice, the Duchess of Athlone. So she comes on again. She's obviously someone who, you know, a grandee. And she talks about the adoption of babies, so a more serious talk. And then they also have Lady Duff Gordon, yeah. So Lady Duff Gordon talks about fashions. So they have, and again, she's a very kind of famous couturier, you know, a famous kind of fashion designer.
And survivor of the Titanic.
They're the two first talks on Women's Hour. There's music as well in this programme.
Some of the talks, including that one on day one, were then repeated on other stations, but voiced by other lady announcers. So London might have the dignitaries, but the same script is then handed out throughout the regions for someone else to read. This was just before simultaneous broadcasting came in, using phone lines to essentially send what was in London, or any station, to all of the others. So before that comes in, the easiest way to replicate the programme is simply to have someone else voice the same words. Which, of course, as Kate said on day one, was Princess Alice, a.k.a. the Duchess of Athlone, a.k.a. Queen Victoria's granddaughter, who in later years sounded like this.
I never learned to cook at all beyond making toffee.
And next episode, we'll have another royal on the radio. We'll feature the first monarch on the BBC 1 year later. That's next time, but this time, back on the 2nd of May 1923, another first that day occurred just after Women's Hour as part of Children's Hour. It's at 5:30, there were children's stories and poems from Kathleen Nesbitt, who will soon give us the first full-length Shakespeare within just a few weeks. Another episode on that yet to come too. But then there's this notable first on the 2nd of May 23, and that is this.
The London uncles will call the Great Ormond Street Hospital, where the first set provided by the nephews and nieces has been installed. Lady Helen Murray will speak on behalf of the hospital.
Ah, so the nephews and nieces then are junior listeners in. They presumably clubbed together to support this hospital radio set for Great Ormond Street Hospital. Now, actually, this means a lot to me. I partly grew up in Great Ormond Street, as I was not a well child. I was in for months at a time on occasions, aged 5, 6, 7, and yeah, I listened to hospital radio there in the early 1980s. I gave requests for songs, and I heard them during my stay there as a child. And years after that, I did request gathering and presenting myself at Hospital Radio Way in Surrey. That was my first taste of radio presenting. So to think that the London uncles were presenting the hospital that I stayed in with their first wireless set on that particular day, at the 2nd of May 1923, well, for me, that kind of brings it full circle. More, by the way, on the radio circle another time, in case you're interested. But for now in our timeline, we are indeed on the 2nd of May 23, when London 2LO ends with, of course, a men's talk, the second one, after Lord Birkenhead's boozy banter the night before. The topic of the second daily men's talk then, which followed the first London women's talk, well, it was given by Major Christie, and it was on
the gentle art of snaring unicorns.
What an unusual title. I've no idea how you snare unicorns at all, even ungently. Major Christie had previously spoken in a non-men's talk, the first proper talk of the BBC, really.
How to Catch a Tiger.
On the 27th of January 1923.
I say, Mr. Jeffries, there's a gentleman here says he wants to give a lecture to the listeners in on how to catch a tiger.
On what?
How to catch a tiger.
Major Christie clearly liked speaking about hunting down bizarre creatures, whether unicorns or tigers.
Here, give me the phone. Hello, sir.
Well, we shall have to consider the idea. You see, we haven't given any lectures so far.
A reimagining there of how that came about from the BBC's Scrapbook programme. Hear from Scrapbook creator Leslie Bailey on our next episode of this podcast. So women's talks and men's talks were bookending each evening for some time then. You'd have women's talks at 5 p.m, men's talks at 10 p.m. Let's look at a few random days from the listings then. On one day here, you've got cookery for the women, starting the evening's programming, and motoring for the men at the end. Another day, poultry chat at 5 o'clock, lawn tennis at 10 o'clock at night. Another one here opens with milk and health. And then lightweight camping closes it for the men later on.
What is capital? How a businessman can keep fit. Next week's sporting features. They're just so funny. Rise of Venice. Trout fishing in Europe. They just make me laugh. They have a lovely chap called Captain 12 Trees. He seems to talk about kind of carburettors and motoring.
Cecil Lewis was in charge of booking these men's talks. Ella Fitzgerald in charge of the women's talks. And Ralph Wade overseeing both strands there in the talks department. Ralph Wade's first task on joining that march in 1923 was to
sit down with the 1923 Who's Who in front of me and write to anyone who sounded as if they had done something colourful with their lives.
But Ralph Wade soon hit a snag. Snaring men, especially to give a talk, was a bit like snaring unicorns, but a less gentle art.
Few speakers were prepared to turn out on cold winter nights to make their way to Savoy Hill to broadcast at 10 p.m. for a purely nominal fee.
I mean, if you were struggling for bookings, I'd have done it for not much. But then that does say a lot about my radio career.
But the kind of separate men's talks fizzle out, I think mainly because actually most talks are aimed at men.
I think you're right. I think
Women's Hour, at the time, this is a real era of women's magazines, women's pages in journals. So the Guardian women's page starts in 1922. There's lots and lots of women's pages coming up. And they have these generic women's magazines. Of course, men don't have generic men's magazines. They have Wireless Today or, you know, Fishing or, you know. So men's magazines are much more kind of specific hobby-based. You don't have men's magazines the same way that you have women's magazines. So I think this is where Men's Hour didn't work. So women are seen as this defined audience. It's aimed at predominantly housewives. At first it's middle class, because these are the women who are predominantly going to have wirelesses, or they're going to have hobby husbands building wirelesses, I suppose. So the tone of the programme is quite middle class. And that's the women who are coming to speak on it and who are making it. That will change as they realise that the audience is changing as more and more people get wireless. But it's just a really interesting programme, Women's Hour.
Topics-wise, it was deliberately like browsing the pages of Good Housekeeping, a magazine which launched just months earlier, in fact.
Mainly domesticity, but also this idea of taking women out of the home. This idea that, you know, while you're peeling your potatoes, you may be getting domestic tips, but you're also having talks on travel or history, all sorts of books. These are expanding your understanding, taking you out of the home. So again, it's all about inform, entertain and educate and all these sorts of things. So it's all rooted in BBC ethos. And it just must have eaten up contributors and trying to get people to come. It's so early, you know, how do you find people? And Ella Fitzgerald would very much have used her own contacts.
The boss, Ella Fitzgerald herself, was on the air a couple of times a week as two pseudonyms.
Ariel's Society Gossip.
Looks like the first direct linking of the name Ariel with the BBC, later the name of the in-house newspaper.
In and Out of the Shops
was presented under her name, The Copycat.
I love this idea of this programme, In and Out of the Shops. It's a very early kind of consumer programme that she said she used to record in her lunch hour. And I'm sure she says that she went into a shop once to chat about something, and then they asked about the fee and they thought they had to pay her to be mentioned. They do kind of poultry keeping, they do lots of things about child welfare, they do bridge and they do tennis. There's lots of cookery. They have Mrs. C.S. Peel, who's a very, very famous kind of cookery writer. She's doing their kitchen cookery items.
That had the editor of Daily Mail's women's page reading from her
Wireless Cookery book,
which wasn't actually a book. She did write a lot of cookbooks, but her Wireless Cookery book was kind of like calling a thing an audiobook. You know, it's a book that you can listen to. The initials CS, by the way, in Mrs. C.S. Peel, were actually the initials of her husband, electrical engineer Charles Steers. All of this, by the way, makes it three times harder to research these women at the start of broadcasting. And I speak from experience because they often have three different names you need to search for. There's a maiden name, a married name, and then just their husband's name with the word Mrs. in front. Can you imagine Holly Willoughby presenting This Morning, but credited as Mrs. D. Baldwin, who, by the way, is the TV executive who brought back Gladiators? I digress. My point is that Mrs. C.S. Peel, Constance Peel, had she had quite a life, actually, achieved great things for women in society via publishing, journalism, government committees. So do look into her further if you fancy. Maybe one day we'll do a whole episode about Mrs. C.S. Peel on the podcast. On request, say if you'd like one. We may start doing profiles of some of these early broadcasting superstars when we've covered more of our broadcasting timeline going day by day, week by week, and so on. For now, though, Kate Murphy, get us back on track for Women's Hour, will you?
So in December 1923, the Women's Advisory Committee is set up. The BBC, from quite early on, they set up these advisory committees because they want to be taken seriously. They need people to understand this is how important and significant broadcasting is. So they set up advisory committees. There's one for the spoken word, there's one for religion. And so they get people who are experts. It works both ways. They give the BBC their advice, but also the BBC can then say, we're now linked to all these grandees. So Ella Fitzgerald's been kind of battling on her own to get her two talks a day. You know, it's quite a lot. As a producer myself, there's a lot of work involved. But the advisory committee comes in, and it's got some fairly, you know, important people. Lady Denman is on it. She chairs the National Federation of Women's Institutes. You've got, they originally had hoped to have Margaret Bonfield on, although she was too busy and couldn't do it. She's an MP. So they had an actress. They had Dorothea Baird, I think, who's an actress. They had Dr. Elizabeth Sloane Chesser, who's a doctor. And they had some other people like Mrs. Hardman Earle, who I think had done something with kitchens and cookery during the First World War, and they had someone who was the kind of president of the Women's Amateur Athletics Association, and also Evelyn Gates, who edited the Women's Yearbook. So these sort of interesting characters sat on this committee, and each of these women oversaw a particular area of expertise. So they started meeting in January 24, and again, so they were suggesting guests and ideas, and so you see that the programme, the quality of things does kind of change once they're there, because they've got extra networks and they have lots of ideas about how we should be doing things. There are debates. They actually introduce interviews, which are almost unheard of on early radio. I mean, you don't really get interviews, but Women's Hour does some interviews.
January 1924, the Women's Advisory Committee decided to have a listener vote on air to see exactly what people wanted to listen to. 2nd of February 1924, that on-air debate.
Discussion Women's Hour between Mrs. Harmon Earle and Mrs. E. Evelyn Gates to ascertain listeners' opinions on the timing and subject matter for the Women's Hour.
Two of them go on to the programme on the Saturday, and they kind of, one of them puts that women want domestic items, and one says that women don't want domestic items, they want escape from domestic drudgery. So they have this kind of debate about what should Women's Hour be, what time should it be? And then they get quite a good response. Quite a few hundred letters come in.
326 women listeners wrote in after the debate. 187 were supporting Miss Gates, who said that we should have professional topics on the air, while just 52 backed Mrs. Harmon Earle's preference for more domestic talks about cookery and needlework and housekeeping. The listeners had spoken.
And that's when they decided to abandon or reduce the number of domestic items on the programme, because people say they don't want to listen to cooking, they'd much rather be taken out of themselves.
And so, a compromise. 2 days a week of domestic talks for Women's Hour, and 4 days a week of escapism. Travel, literature, education, the arts. 26 people, by the way, responded saying they wanted no change and the BBC had it just right.
They also changed the time, so I think it moved to 4 p.m. That's really an example of the kind of listener power, in a way, that they have that. But also quite intriguing that at the same time, they decide that they don't want to be called Women's Hour. They decide that the name has to go. Again, there's so many reasons why that might have happened. These women are broadly feminist women, the very nature of being women in the public eye. I imagine that they didn't like the idea of being singled out. And women's hour, why would women get preferential treatment? There's lots of debates about this, you know, why they might have felt that they didn't want the word women's hour. So by March 24, it's not called women's hour. They still do lots of women's programmes, but the name is dropped and it becomes programmes of interest to women. And I think that's eventually why women's programmes, women's talks dwindle. It's not a defined programme anymore. So then they start eating into the allocated time. And then schools' broadcasts need to find space. Another thing, so women's talks are kind of pushed out more and more. And eventually, by the end of 25, there are so few women's talks. That's when they disband the Women's Advisory Committee, which it meets for the final time, I think, in December 1924. So it runs for a year. But then after that, they don't meet again. And that's when you really see this dip in women's talks. And because I worked on Women's Hour for such a long time, and I joined just after... I joined in 93, which is just shortly after the threat to take away Women's Hour's names. And that's when it moved to the morning. And there was this massive campaign to keep the Women's Hour name. So I can understand why that branding has kept Women's Hour in the public eye. And Women's Hour, once it had gone, it's very hard then even to find records that there were women's talks. And in fact, when I started at Women's Hour, the information was that Women's Hour was the first women's programme on the BBC.
Right.
You know, so that was in 1946. So as far as I knew, when I was at Women's Hour, there was nothing for women on the BBC before 1946. And a lot of that, I think, is because if you look in any kind of TV, you know, TV books or BBC, all the BBC annuals, BBC yearbooks, they talk about Children's Hour because it's a defined thing. But of course, Women's Hour wasn't defined.
And in September 1926, Ella Fitzgerald left her job as women's boss for a new role in publications on World Radio. And that pretty much concludes the British Broadcasting Company years. As the British Broadcasting Corporation launched in January 1927, there was a new employee at the BBC, Hilda Matheson, in the talks department, and very quickly she was running it. The only female employee headhunted by Reith himself in the pre-war BBC.
Hilda Matheson, when she comes in, she reinstates women's programme because she's so good at kind of this idea of branding, I suppose. She gets broadcasting gravitas. And women's programmes, again, they have defined time slots, and she has much more, very different approach to kind of expert speakers and all sorts of things. So she does change women's talks a lot.
Hilda Matheson wrote in her book, Broadcasting,
"The evidence from women, particularly poorer women, as to what a wireless set may mean to them is one of the most remarkable and encouraging results of broadcasting. There is an equally strong demand for talks outside the common line of household drudgery, on travel, on books, on how people live in other countries, which may be given in simple terms at hours of the day when busy women can most easily enjoy a pause."
Ah yes, radio that transports you to another place. We will come back to Hilda Matheson and later women's broadcasting, fear not. Well, this episode, huge thanks to Dr. Kate Murphy, because so many articles, theses, books, and anywhere you want to look about early women's broadcasting, it's got the fingerprints of Dr. Kate Murphy all over it. So buy her books, Behind the Wireless, A History of Early Women at the BBC, and Hilda Matheson, A Life of Secrets and Broadcasts. Link in the show notes. Thank you, Kate. Thanks to this episode, particularly to our patrons. So if you join us on patreon.com/PaulCarenza, and you can get all the bonus bits and pieces, videos, behind-the-scenesy things, at least once a month we send out something either text-based or video-based, most recently a little walking tour between Savoy Hill, the Savoy Hotel, and Marconi House. So a huge and heartfelt thank you to our patrons who support this podcast: Andrew Jervis, Chris Toundrow, Andrew Barker, Dave and Jackie, Sarah Norwood Muirs, Russ Anderson, Andrew Deacon, David Jervis, Keith Marsh, Matt Lacey, Adam Wynne Stanley, Michelle Gersick, John Hartman, Robert Godfrey, Sean Jacks, Neil Jackson, James Morgan, Adrian Pell, Jerry Ralph, Charlotte Connolly, Chris Queen, Mark Allinson, Hannah Fleming Hill, Greenbank Records, more of them on the podcast soon, Steve Smallwood, and most recently Roger Rainey. Thank you, all of you. If you would like to join them, support the podcast, and indeed get video and text things in return, patreon.com/PaulCarenza, or indeed you can just tip us the price of a cup of coffee if you would prefer, ko-fi.com/PaulCarenza. Cheers to you. And you know what? Cheers if you don't. Thank you for any shares you've been doing of this podcast. We've had a couple of new reviews. Thank you so much. The reviews really help get this podcast noticed. Or indeed, just thanks for listening. If you would like to email the podcast any thoughts of what you'd like to hear more of or less of, or any general feedback, open to your emails, paul@paulcarenza.com. Next time, although we're continuing to tell the tale of May 1923, I do notice that at the time of recording here in April 2024, it's about the centenary of the oldest BBC recording that we still have that we can listen to. More next time on why that recording of King George V, first monarch on the BBC, is sort of, really, the earliest recording of a broadcast. It's worth leaping ahead a year then, to April 1924, for one episode to tell the tale of that first royal recording. And let's get lost in the archives, shall we? Simon Rooks, the former BBC archivist, returns to tell us more. Finally, Catch Me on Tour, an evening of very old radio, visits Guildford, Gloucestershire, Bedford, Sussex, Kent, Frinton-on-Sea as well this summer. Also doing a walking tour in London. Email me if you're interested in joining that. But for the main tour around venues, around theatres, paulcarenza.com/tour has details of an evening of very old radio. Join me! And thanks once again to Dr. Kate Murphy, and hip hip hurrah to Women's Hour. Hip hip? I'll leave a pause there for you to say hooray. Thanks.
The British Broadcasting Century is a solo-operated podcast just run by little old Paul Carenza, with original music by Will Farmer. Nothing to do with the BBC whatsoever, and all broadcasts of this vintage are generally out of copyright, so we believe. Some rights, though, may reside with players or writers or their families. If that's you and you have any issues, do drop us a line. The joy of podcasting, we can edit and edit out anytime we choose. It's all one giant work in progress to inform, educate and entertain.
Join us next time for the earliest recording of a BBC broadcast. Yes, please stand for the King, here on the British Broadcasting Century.